started here is because, as you say, this Senate File 559, we've nicknamed it the Grand Rapids Property Tax Relief Bill. So, and of course, the use of this would be to implement a local sales tax to offset LGA and provide some property tax relief. As you already offered, the mayor's here. And if you can believe it, on St. Patrick's Day, the administrator's here, too. His name is Sean Gillen. So we have some other referees. We have the engineer and recognize another counselor from the city of Grand Rapids, Gary McInerney, which is an appropriate name today, too.
Sounds a bit Scottish to me. I just want to make sure.
Yeah. Good. But anyway, so as you have already done, we'll recognize the mayor, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Senator Ortman, and thank you for including us and giving us the ability to come down and speak with you this morning. We do appreciate the Senate's willingness to take up this issue on behalf of Grand Rapids, and we would hope that whatever you can do to help us out is greatly appreciated from our residents up there. Sean Gillen, a city administrator, will do most of the talking this morning. I just wanted to preface his remarks with, as we've been working, and I've been with the city of Grand Rapids now for going on 6 years, as we've been working at trying to control costs, and I think if you look at the records in Grand Rapids, our tax rate that we have as a city has been decreasing over these last 6 years, and that's not always easy to do with what's been happening in the state of Minnesota and what's been happening nationally with the economy. So we've been trying to do our part, and as we use up arrows out of our quiver, so to speak, you get to the point where you're limited in what you can and can't do as a city in order to balance our budget. We've cut a lot out of our budget over the last few years. We've taken some hits on the LGA side, and we've still been able to take that tax rate down. So with that, we are hoping that one of the opportunities that as LGA maybe goes or stays, whatever form that's in, that a local option sales tax would be beneficial to us. It allows people that use our facilities and come through our area to help support and offset some of the costs that the residents are currently bearing from the infrastructure and the infrastructure wear that happens as a result of being a regional hub from the aspect of tourism and trade. So with that, I would turn it over to our city administrator.
Mr. Gillen, welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you very much, Senators. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. The mayor has asked me to kind of briefly discuss what the things that we have done over the last couple of years to deal with the economic times that we're in. Specifically, we've lost $1.1 million in revenue, annual revenue, due to LGA loss, our market value homestead credit loss, fiscal disparities, contribution increases, and a loss of about $17 million in commercial industrial property value. To respond to that, we had enough room in our levy, under our levy limit, to simply tax our way out of that. The council has chosen to not do that. They asked me to keep service levels the same, answer this revenue loss, and reduce taxes. So, as they say, I like a challenge. But we responded very well. The staff and the council have made some pretty bold moves over the last few years to reduce our expenditures by $1 million a year, just over $1 million per year. So that means over the next 5 years, the taxpayers will not have to pay $5 million in taxes. And that's something that we're very proud of. What we've got now is we've budgeted to receive about $950,000 in LGA. We would like to try to reduce our costs even further, annual permanent reductions, so we can use any LGA that we did get just as capital on capital expenditures, rather than making it an operating revenue, which seems to be the problem that we're experiencing. We're seeing a large fluctuation in that revenue stream, and we can't operate that way. So we're continuing working on several different initiatives, including collaborating with our public utility, collaborating with our neighbors to reduce costs and centralize services. But you can only reduce costs so much. The sales tax that we're asking for is a little bit different than most of the other sales tax proposals, I understand, is that it would be used for capital improvements, including debt service on capital improvements that have already been done. But we would like to see it as if we continue to reduce costs, reduce that reliance on LGA, that these revenues would then would be offset with a property tax reduction. So a half-cent sales tax in Grand Rapids would generate approximately $1 million in revenue. If we can continue to cut costs, we can apply that all to property tax reductions, we're saving the homeowner about $100 to $150 for every assessed every $100,000 in market value on their home. So we see that as a significant savings to the taxpayer and an improvement to the development of the entire region. So I don't want to get into too much detail on that, and I would like to reserve as much time as possible to answer questions that you or the committee may have. So,
Mr. Gillen and Mr. Mayor, you are not the first folks here to request a local option sales tax. We've had quite a bit of a conversation about this, and so we've previewed what's going on in your city as well. A question for you. Many of the proposals have been for a half cent. Why is your proposal for up to 1%? And you just previously mentioned that a half percent would create a certain amount of funding for your capital bonding. So
right.
Why the 1%?
Well, we saw what we looked at was how can we replace LGA. Madam Chair. One of the things we looked at was the amount of LGA that we still had as an operating revenue was nearly $1 million, and we wanted to reduce property taxes. So 1% would generate about $2 million. And allow us to completely replace our LGA loss, maintain service levels, and provide significant property tax relief.
Well, if I may, how would you implement that? You would just transfer the local option sales tax revenues, half of them or approximately half of them, into your operating funds?
We would be used for capital improvements, either to pay bonds or to not bond for future capital projects.
So what you're saying is you would have a reduction in your operating costs because you'd have a designated source for your capital bonds, and because you wouldn't have to pay for any of that debt service out of your operating, that would be a meaningful reduction in the property tax.
Yeah, the overall levy would decrease by an equal dollar amount.
I know at some point, Mr. Mayor or Mr. Gillen, you talked about a potential LGA offset. Have you changed your mind on that, and can you just share with us your thinking on that?
Well, I think originally we had proposed a bill a year ago that basically stated that every dollar generated in sales tax would go to offset $1 in LGA, and anything above our certified LGA would go to property tax reduction. We're familiar with the situation that you're in, and we're aware of the inevitable reductions that may be coming in LGA, and we thought that might be a superfluous language in the bill at that point. But if that's something that we want to discuss, we're willing to look at that as an option. But we don't want to take away the value of that program at all. So.
Understood. Mr. Gillen, one other thing. You talked about the fiscal disparities in your commercial industrial base when you were talking mm-hmm. about your circumstances. Are you saying that Grand Rapids is part of the fiscal disparities program, and are you a payer into a fiscal disparities program? Can you talk about that?
We are part of the Iron Range Fiscal Disparities Program. We are a net contributor and always have been to the program. 2 years ago, we had what I refer to as the double whammy. That is a loss of about $17 million in commercial industrial value, which shrank our tax base, which meant that we had to have a higher rate to generate the same amount of revenue. So we had to lower our levy to match that. At the same time, the fiscal disparities uses the data from the previous year, which we had about an $18 million growth in commercial industrial value, which meant that our LGA or contribution of tax base doubled. In dollar amounts, it's about a $412,000 net loss in tax revenue to the citizens of Grand Rapids. It is what it is, as we say. But that was just a unique situation of the economic times and the timing of the data usage.
Mr. Gillen, how much is that $412,000 as compared to your annual budget?
That would be approximately 5 to 7% of our annual budget. If I'm doing math very quickly in my head, so if I'm incorrect, Madam Chair, I apologize.
No, rough estimate is excellent. Thank you. Other members, questions or comments about the Park Rapids proposal?
Grand Rapids.
Grand Rapids. Oh, my goodness. I apologize.
It's okay.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, could you state what the LGA you're certified for, or what and what LGA you expect under the last guidance, and maybe tell me what you budgeted for in LGA?
Madam Chair, Senator, we are certified to receive approximately $1.37 million in LGA for fiscal year 2011. We have budgeted to receive just under $950,000. So we've budgeted for about a $400,000, $450,000 cushion to absorb any potential LGA losses. We've been working on getting to that position for about 2 years. That's how long it took us to be able to do that. So that's where I get that $950,000 number. That's still the LGA that we're relying on for operating. And I'll get back to originally to my statement that we could have taxed. We have about $800,000 in levy under our levy limit that we could have just simply taxed our way out of that problem, but we chose not to.
All right.
Follow up.
Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, could you tell me, do you get any additional aid besides LGA as far as like regional shopping aid or anything?
Madam Chair, Senator, the only other significant aid that we receive is the market value homestead credit, which is we took about a $218,000 lost hit to last year after the budget had been completed. And I think that's where the preliminary numbers I saw was equivalent to what we're going to see for this fiscal year. But again, those numbers are approximate.
Thank you. With out objection, I would like to lay Senate File 559 and the proposal from Grand Rapids over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Saxon.
Madam Chair, members.
Did you have any final comments? I should have asked.
Apologize. Well, no, you took the words right out of my mouth, Madam Chair. And thank you, and happy St. Patrick's Day.
Thank you, and the same to you.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity.
I wish you all a safe drive back. It's a long ways. Members, we are going to take Senator Bach out of order. He has asked to go first. He's got another commitment out of the committee. And because we've heard local option sales taxes is nothing new, and Senator Bach, you and the representatives Hermantown, very welcome in the committee. Senate File 661 is that local option sales tax for Hermantown. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hermantown is the suburban community in my district, if you believe that an Iron Ranger could have a suburban community. But it is one of the newest incorporated cities in our state. It was incorporated in 1976, I believe. It's right on the outside of Duluth, kind of on the upper hillside. So if you get up on the upper hillside of Duluth, if you know where the mall is, that's actually in Duluth. But as soon as you get north of the mall, you get into Hermantown. So that area up there where a lot of the commercial business is actually in the city of Hermantown. It's not in the city of Duluth. A number of years ago, I believe back in 1997, I was actually one of the authors of a bill over in the other body to authorize the city of Hermantown to get a local option sales tax to build out that new community's infrastructure as they started to grow and sprawl, move away from on-site sewer systems onto municipal sewer, move away from wells onto water lines, put in streets, and all of that infrastructure that a growing suburban community needs. They asked for a local option sales tax. It was interestingly, it actually passed out of the tax committee at 1%, the mayor then came down and indicated that they didn't think they needed 1%, that they half a percent would be enough, and so what ended up enacted into law was a half a percent sales tax. This request is actually to increase that half a percent, not to change the existing uses, but to increase that half a percent to 1% so that they can build out more of that infrastructure. It's all the same uses, but just build more of it. The current sales tax is not collecting enough money to meet the needs. And Madam Chair, allowing them to go to 1% would make them an outlier because all of these local options are a half a percent, excluding the city of Duluth, their neighbor. The city of Duluth does have a 1% local option, so this would put Hermantown consistent with their neighboring city of Duluth. So I don't think there's the outlier issue there because the neighboring city of Duluth has 1%. So that concludes what I have to say about the project, Madam Chair, and I have the city administrator from Hermantown here to speak to it.
Thank you. Mr. Mulder, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Senator Bach said, we have originally were authorized up to 1%, but the city only implemented a half a percent. And as we've gone through this, the revenues haven't been as what we have projected. And in fact, in 2010, we actually collected less than what we did in 2006. So the projections haven't met our expectations. And the projections on the costs have actually exceeded what we thought they would be. So we've had some overruns in installing some of those sewer lines. So that's one of the concerns, is that we have less revenue than we thought and more expenses than we thought. So we're concerned about the long-term, our ability the long-term to pay for that. Plus, we also have areas where we believe that there will be additional growth. We are contemplating an improvement in a water main right now that would be done by assessments. But if that project were to go through, and we're not sure at this point whether it will, but if it were to go through, down the road, that's going to require us to build another water tower. City of Hermantown continues to grow throughout that the current recession, so that's why we'd like to implement that additional 0.5% sales tax.
Mr. Mulder, how much does the 0.5% collect now per year?
Approximately just about $1 million.
And so you're looking at a need of $2 million in order to manage the projects that you already have underway?
Yeah, we have about $1.4 million a year in debt service right now, and we're collecting $1 million. So we're not covering all of our debt service at this point.
Questions about the proposal from Hermantown? Senator
Bach. Madam Chair, you notice the bill does require a referendum. And the other thing I would say is I was looking at the census numbers yesterday, and the B side of my district that includes Hermantown actually grew, and it actually has more people. Representative Murphy's district actually has more people than she needs for under the current census number. So this is an area that's growing, and those of you that represent suburban communities understand what kind of stress that puts on.
Senator Bach, do you have a different position now on waste treatment systems? I mean, when we talked about that, I think you were a little concerned about expanding sales taxes to pay for that.
Madam Chair, I don't think this has the sewage treatment plant on it. I think the previous ones were about sewage treatment plants that qualify for WIF funding. This is more about building out the public infrastructure of the actual water lines and the sewer lines, not the actual sewage treatment plant. The City of Hermantown sewage treatment actually goes to the WLSSD, the Waste Western Lake Superior Sanitary District, which is a huge sewer district, including Duluth, all the way out to Cloquet and up Hermantown and some of the townships north of Hermantown and up the North Shore. All of it comes under one central sewer plant in the western Duluth.
I don't see the distinction as clearly as you do, but I'm no expert in... I'm good with the explanation. So are there folks here that might like to speak in favor or against the Hermantown proposal? Members, comments, or questions? Without objection, I'd like to lay Senate File 661 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I am going to have another bill. As long as I have Hermantown here, let me just briefly say, Hermantown is a city that has, I believe, four zip codes?
Yes.
Four zip codes in it. So Department of Revenue has really been having some trouble because they normally assign sales tax collections based on zip code. And because some of the zip codes in Duluth are shared with the zip code, same zip code as Hermantown, we have an issue, and I'm bringing a bill later to have the department study that and figure out collections really need to be remitted based on the nine-numbered zip code, not on the five number one. We believe that Hermantown is actually probably losing some significant money to the City of Duluth, who I also represent part of, but just because of overlapping zip codes that are in both cities. So that's a bill I've actually introduced that I hope to be able to talk about later.
Madam Chair.
Senator
Limmer. Madam Chair, Senator Bach, on that issue, can't you just work it out between cities and Duluth would give some money back to Hermantown?
Well, I don't think the issue is between cities, Senator Limmer. I think the issue is the we need to make sure the business actually remits based on their nine-digit code so the Department of Revenue knows what city to assign the revenue to.
I get it. So. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bach, and thank you, Mr. Mulder.
Thank you very much.
Down here. We're going to hear about cigarettes now. We're going to hear from Senator Rosen and Senator Nelson, Senate Files 493 and Senate File 770. They both deal with the definition of a cigarette. Senator Rosen, would you like to begin?
Thank you.
Welcome.
And Chair. This is a little formidable.
This is a formidable group, I'm telling you.
Senate File 493, Madam Chair and members, and Senate File 770, which I'll let Senator Nelson talk about a little bit later. There are some significant differences, but basically they're addressing the major loophole in our current cigarette definition. I have my props that I've forgotten. I'm sorry.
Senator Rosen, there are some handouts that are being handed out.
Thank you.
The Tobacco Uniformity Act of 2011, Little Cigar Bill. And Senator Rosen, we have an amendment for you here whenever you're ready on that.
Thank you. Thank you. Yep, yeah. Currently, the Minnesota classifies these little cigars as OTPs, as other tobacco products, which are taxed at 70% of their wholesale price. So they're not subject to the 35-cent non-settlement fee. They're not required to have a state tax stamp, and they do not fall under the minimum price law. Problem is, these little cigars look just like cigarettes. They are in a pack of 20. Now, this is a double pack of Swisher Sweets, but they're in a pack of 20. They have filters just like cigarettes, and they inhale just like cigarettes. So the real difference is that their wrapper has a bit of reconstituted tobacco pulp in the paper, and that's what makes it turn brown. And that's why they can call them cigars, which allows them to add flavorings in them, such as chocolate, raspberry, whatever you want. And these are being basically bought and marketed to the kids. So Minnesota law treats the cigarettes and little cigars very differently through taxation and commerce regulation. So this bill and Senator Nelson's bill would broaden the statutory definition of cigarettes to include products usually sold under the name of little cigars but marketed as cigarettes. So they'll be subject to the same fees and taxes as cigarettes. They'll be subject to have the Department of Revenue tax stamps to ensure tax compliance and reduce tax evasion. And they'll be subject to the state's minimum price law. My bill, which is different than Senator Nelson's, would also direct the Department of Revenue to report to the 2012 legislature on the tobacco tax collection system. This report would provide information and guidance to the legislature on possible improvements to the tobacco tax collection system, and it would include recommendations that will help with the compliance. And unfortunately, the fiscal note came in at $100,000. And I do have the A1 amendment that I'd like to move.
The study came in at $100,000?
Madam Chair, it did, yes. But, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Thank you. Senator Rosen, would you just like to explain what the amendment
Absolutely,
does?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. First of all, it does mention that on page 1, line 16, that the study is for $100,000 for the Department of Revenue to do this tobacco tax collection compliance. It also clarifies the statute by striking little cigars in 297F.01, and it changes the enactment date to July 1st of 2011. And with that, Madam Chair, I would like to turn it over to Senator Nelson.
Senator Rosen, before we do that, can I ask a question about your amendment? And we'll adopt your amendment for your bill in just a moment. But
thank you.
About your amendment, I'm looking at the list. Cigars, little cigars, chair roots, I don't even know what all these things are, I'll be honest. And by the way, thanks for the handout, but there's no smoking in the Capitol. The little cigars... Are we saying that if you take them out of here, then they get taxed like cigarettes because they are not exempted from the definition?
Exactly, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Rosen would offer the A1 amendment. It is an author's amendment. I hope members would show her the courtesy we usually do. With all those in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The A1 is adopted. Okay. Senator Nelson, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for allowing me to bring Senate File 770 before you. I don't know. Do we need someone from the committee to move that since I'm not on your committee?
We can hear it now, and
okay,
we will
wonderful.
Move it at the end of your presentation.
Thank
you. Do you have an amendment, Senator Nelson, that needs to be adopted?
Actually, I do not, because I think Senator Rosen's amendment will take care of that, and that my bill is basically about the same.
All right.
So
good.
I think they'll probably
so
go.
So if you want to just explain your bill,
yes.
That would be great.
Actually, 770 is basically the part that concerned me was that, you know, these are marketed to children. I mean, if you were to look at this, you would just say this is a brown cigarette. And what caught my attention was the fact that they were really marketed to kids with the flavors, the grape and the orange. And so when I started looking into it, it wasn't until I was concerned about why they were marketing to children that I found out that they were so much cheaper. And that's really the genesis of the bill. Part of the reason that these are so cheap is, as Senator Rosen said, they're really not taxed like the product that they are disguising to be. And so Senate File 770 basically just calls these what most of us would say they are, and that's cigarettes. And therefore, they would be under the same taxing structure as cigarettes. And again, we know that our youth are those that are most price sensitive. So I felt like this was a loophole that was being used to keep these products at a cheaper price so that young people would be more likely to buy these. And so my bill simply states it expands the definition to include these particular items as cigarettes. And it's because of including there's just a little bit of tobacco in the wrapper.
So, Senator Nelson, would you be amenable to our proceeding with Senator Rosen's file to accomplish your goals?
Yes, actually, it would very much it would accomplish the same goal. I did not know Senator Rosen had written this bill when I put mine in, and I also support the second part of Senator Rosen's bill, which is the study. I think, and I have a bill that does the same thing only in a separate bill. So I think proceeding with Senator Rosen's bill will accomplish both the goals that I had in
Great.
One fell swoop.
Great, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. You know, in the last 10 years. Minnesota has taken really great strides in reducing smoking and dealing with that issue and all the ancillary costs that come with that, whether it's the freedom to breathe or our tobacco tax or usage or tobacco user fee. So because of that, Minnesota's rate of smoking has dropped double than what the national average is. So it went from 22% to 16%. And that is excellent. So all you have to do is really sit on Health and Human Services Budget Committee and look at some of these, the cost of smoking that's coming in. And I know, too, just working, in the drug world the last few years, you can talk to any. Thank you, Madam Chair, for laughing. But you could talk to any drug counselor or anybody from Hazleton, anybody that works with kids and youth, and they say the number one addiction out there for these kids is tobacco. And if we can get that under control, we have done major strides, because it starts with tobacco, and then it can go to pot, and then it can go to other drugs. And they will all line up, and they will say the same thing. So these little cigars are very attractive. Many are smaller, I will admit. Some are smaller, and so there's going to be issues as far as putting on the state tax stamp on that. But when you look at this, and this is a cute little wrap, pink, this is a camel, and this is a little Switcher Sweet in purple. So who are they really marketing these little cigars to? And so all we're saying is please tax them as cigarettes, because the kids are, and this is the reason that I took this bill, and it's not for the tax revenue that's coming in, generating in the state. It is because I wanted to address this with the kids. And all you have to do is go to your Cancer Society and your the walkathons that they have every year in the county, and you listen to these dramatic talks about cancer and smoking, and this is just one step to addressing this issue, and I think it's a fair thing. Actually, 13 states and the federal government have moved to treat these little cigars as cigarettes for the purpose of taxation, and they have set the weight threshold at 3 pounds or less per thousand. And as a result, the little cigars manufacturers have adjusted the weight of their product to be above the 3 pounds threshold, allowing them to evade proper taxation. And so this bill would address this threshold issue by going up to the 4.5 pounds per thousand. With that, too, Madam Chair, I do have Ms. Molly Moylanen. Did I say that right?
Well, it's Moylanen.
It sounds
Moylanen.
Irish.
Sounds
to
good
me, too.
And Irish to me.
Yeah.
It's actually Finnish.
Ms. Moylanen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, Senator Nelson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 493, the Tobacco Uniformity Act of 2011. My name is Molly Moylanen, and I'm the Director of Public Affairs for Clearway, Minnesota. Clearway, Minnesota is the independent nonprofit founded with 3% of the 1998 tobacco settlement. Our vision is to eliminate the harm tobacco causes the people of Minnesota. I represent a coalition of organizations supporting this bill, including Clearway, Minnesota, the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, the Association for Non-Smokers Minnesota, the American Lung Association, Blue Cross, Health Partners, the Minnesota Medical Association, the Mayo Clinic, and the local public health association, among others. Please feel free to follow along in the handout. I'm here today to talk about a loophole in our laws regulating tobacco. These laws were crafted in the 20th century. Now it's the 21st century, and unfortunately, the laws haven't kept up with the evolving tobacco industry. Last year, Minnesota took an important step in the right direction. The legislature passed the Tobacco Modernization and Compliance Act, mandating that all tobacco products be sold behind the counter, not next to candied gum in clear reach of kids. Now it's time to take another step forward. Senate File 493 is that step. It is a common-sense bill that closes a problematic loophole. Cheap, under-regulated tobacco products put kids at risk and undermine the integrity of our regulations. By correctly classifying so-called little cigars as what they really are, cigarettes, this bill will prevent that from happening. So let me talk a little bit more about what little cigars are. That's simple. They are cigarettes. They are the same size as cigarettes. Their physical appearance and construction are the same as cigarettes. They are most often sold in packs of 20 like cigarettes. They are usually filtered just like cigarettes. They are smoked the same as cigarettes. Smokers inhale them as deeply into their lungs as they do cigarettes. They contain as much nicotine. They are just as addictive and just as dangerous as cigarettes. One of the most notable similarities is that they are marketed to and experienced by consumers as cigarettes. If you turn to the last page of your handout, you can see if the products were removed from these ads, you would be hard-pressed to identify which ad was for cigars and which was for cigarettes. A more difficult question might be, how are they different from cigarettes? Well, two ways. First, the so-called little cigar, instead of being wrapped in white paper, is wrapped in brown paper. Second, a pack of cigarettes costs between $5 and $6 a pack, where this pack can cost $2 or even less. The reason for their discrepancy is that so-called little cigars are misclassified in statute, resulting in incorrect taxation. Our current legal definitions are so outdated that they allow these brown cigarettes to be treated the same as large traditional cigars, when anyone can see they are clearly different. The classic cigar is wrapped in whole leaf tobacco. The brown color in the little cigar paper comes from a small amount of reconstituted tobacco mixed in with the pulp. A traditional cigar is not filtered, is often not inhaled, and can take an hour or more to smoke. Little cigars are designed to be smoked just as quickly and easily as cigarettes, and many can be consumed by a smoker over a single day. The tobacco companies that manufacture little cigars are well aware of the loophole in the law and are happy to capitalize on it. Currently, these little cigars are not subject to the tax stamps required for cigarettes, including the excise tax and health impact fee. Instead, they are just taxed at 70% of the wholesale price. Because many of these products are deep discount, this turns out to be a significant difference in tax burden. That is why these products can be bought in our marketplace for $2 or less. In addition, I'd also like to point out that these evade the federal ban on flavored cigarettes. And in fact, little cigars often come in candy and fruit flavors. In Minnesota, we have seen them in chocolate and strawberry, grape and peach, even alcohol flavors, in a transparent effort to appeal to young people. The combination of low price, availability, and flavoring make so-called little cigars a huge concern for youth smoking. When we look at it this way, the issue is simple. Research shows us when the price of tobacco goes up, adult smoking goes down, youth smoking initiation goes down, and health care costs go down. On the flip side, cheap, accessible, candy-flavored tobacco increases the odds of hooking new tobacco users. And this is exactly what little cigars do. So what is the solution? That is also simple. We need to modernize the definition of cigarette in our tax and commerce statutes so there is tax compliance, and call this so-called little cigar what it is, a cigarette. I anticipate that you'll hear opponents of the bill argue that the new definition doesn't consider all possible products and that the change will create great confusion. During the interim, we worked hard on the proposed definition to ensure that we are only dealing with so-called little cigars. The traditional large cigars I discussed earlier, as well as cigarillos and true little cigars wrapped in whole leaf tobacco, will not be touched in any way by this change. Opponents to the change might also argue that this isn't a problem because little cigars make up such a small portion of the tobacco market. While the market share is small, make no mistake, for decades, little cigars have been exploiting state and federal loopholes and changes in the marketplace, positioning themselves as the preferred alternative to expensive cigarettes. And their use has increased steadily. Nationally, as cigarette prices have risen through tax increases and manufacturer price increases, smokers have been downgrading to the significantly cheaper little cigars. In addition, as regulations of cigarettes have increased, like the federal ban on flavored cigarettes, little cigars have grown in popularity. In the U.S., little cigar consumption increased from approximately 1.4 billion sticks in 1995 to approximately 3.8 billion sticks in 2005, according to the USDA. The CDC reports that the sales of little cigars increased 240% between 1997 and 2007. Let me share a quote from Jane Green, Vice President of Marketing at Swisher International, maker of Swisher Sweets. Consumers in every category are looking for value, and smokers are no different. Little cigars offer value to smokers who are no longer willing to pay premium prices. She goes on to say, according to Nielsen Company, for the week ending November 1, 2008, the little cigar category grew by 23.5%. That's the kind of growth no retailer should ignore. Minnesota isn't the only state dealing with this issue. This is a recognized problem. Several states and the federal government have moved to treat little cigars as cigarettes for the purposes of taxation. The second part of the bill seeks to create a path to address this problem that only cigarettes are stamped. No other tobacco products have to be stamped, and therefore it's harder to enforce the law and detect tax evasion. We are asking the Department of Revenue to study the issue and make a recommendation to the legislature on how to move forward with a more secure and complete system. In closing, one last point cannot be overlooked. The plain fact is that right now Minnesota is losing millions in revenue because of improper taxation of little cigars. While it may seem like just a small tax compliance issue, there will be large consequences if we fail to take action. If we don't update our definition of cigarette, the state will continue to lose out on millions of dollars in tax revenue, and little cigars will continue to undermine our shared goal of preventing kids from buying that first pack. Regardless of your position on other tobacco issues, this is a non-controversial step that the majority of Minnesotans would support in order to ensure that that the proper taxes are being paid and that our youth are protected from cheap and kid-friendly flavored tobacco products. The power is yours to address this issue and achieve true tax compliance on the taxation of cigarettes. Thank you for your time. I have Claire, a student, here with me, too.
Welcome. And Ms. Tedford, you're here with the American Cancer Society?
Yes.
If you could, address your comments to information that might not have already been provided to the committee, because we do have some folks here that want to testify to the other side.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Claire Tedford, and I graduated from Southwest High School in Minneapolis last year. I'm here today to tell you why it is important to pass the Tobacco Uniformity Act, which raises the price of little cigars so that they are as expensive as cigarettes. This is important to me because my parents are doctors and have taught me about the dangers of smoking. Little cigars are just like cigarettes, but cheaper. People under 18 aren't legally allowed to buy cigarettes or little cigars, but many of them do. If they don't buy them from a gas station or convenience store, they get an older friend or relative to do it for them. Cigarettes cost more than $4 a pack, but little cigars cost less than a cup of coffee at Caribou. Little cigars come in flavors that kids like grape and chocolate. Taking that first puff can be a nasty experience, but the sweet flavor masks the bad taste and makes it easier for kids to start smoking. Most teens start smoking to be rebellious or because they think it's cool. Warning them about cancer and other dangers just doesn't work. But making tobacco more expensive and less attractive does make a difference. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I urge you to support the Tobacco Uniformity Act and treat little cigars just like cigarettes.
Ms. Tedford, very good job. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
We also have Thomas Bryant, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers Association, if you would like to join us, sir.
Madam Chair, I have two handouts to the page.
We will help you with that. Mr. Holton as well.
No.
Mr. Bryant, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Bryant, and I represent the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers Association. That is a group of the Minnesota tobacco wholesalers that stamp cigarettes and sell tobacco products. First, one thing to note before I talk about the cigarette stamping process and how that would apply to little cigars. The Federal Department of Health and Human Services does an annual survey of tobacco use and drug use among youth and adults. In their most recent survey in 2009, they found that only 4% of youth under the age of 18 have used any type of cigar on the most recent basis. Now, that's large cigars and little cigars. And since little cigars are a subset of that, we're talking maybe 1% or 2% of youth that do smoke use little cigars. So it's a very small percentage of youth that actually use little cigars. Currently, only 12 states plus the District of Columbia tax little cigars as cigarettes. The important part of that is this. 5 of those 12 states require little cigars to be taxed and have the tax stamp of that state affixed to each package. 7 states do not require the stamping of little cigars. There are literally hundreds of brands of little cigars. This is the one that one of the prior testimony people spoke about. It's Swisher Mini Cigarellos. She indicated this would not be subject to the law as amended. Yes, it would. This product is very popular. It is a little cigar. It is wrapped in reconstituted paper. The federal government defines that as 2/3 tobacco and 1/3 paper. This would be subject to the cigarette tax. The problem is this. We can't affix the cigarette stamp to this. You have in front of you a diagram of a cigarette stamping machine. If you could take a look at that for just a second, please. These machines cost about $100,000. Each of my wholesalers owns one or leases one. The cigarettes are put in the ramp on the right-hand side, and this is a carton of cigarettes. This is how it goes through. The machine opens the bottom flaps, affixes the yellow cigarette stamp on the bottom of each pack all at the same time, recloses the first flap, applies glue, closes the second flap, and shoots it down to the other end. These are very high-speed machines. They can stamp about 30,000 packs per hour. It takes 2 employees to operate the machine, one on either end. Those machines can only stamp packages that are the size of cigarettes. I concur. There are some packages of little cigars that are the same size as a pack of cigarettes. Those could be stamped. But a significant majority of little cigars don't have the same size packaging. Those machines can only adjust for height, not width. This little pack won't go through that machine. It has to be hand stamped. This is a sheet of cigarette tax stamps. The little stamp is wider than the bottom of this pack. It won't fit. This is a hand-stamping iron. It looks like a soldering iron from maybe junior high or high school shop class, if you recall that. It's one at a time. And that's if the stamp comes off cleanly. So they have to take the package, stand it up, put the paper on the top, and then stamp it down like this. And that's if it'll fit. A good hand stamper can stamp about 350 packs per hour, as compared to the machine, which can stamp 30,000 packs per hour. One of my wholesalers is also a wholesaler in Iowa. Iowa has a tax law like is being proposed, where you have to tax little cigars as cigarettes. They have stopped selling over half of the brands of little cigars because they'd have to hand stamp them. It's not practical, it's burdensome, time intensive, and expensive to have people do that. So what they've done is stopped selling about 50% of the brands of little cigars. That, in effect, is a de facto prohibition on the sale of those legal tobacco products. One last thing to speak about. If you turn to the color chart, there are a number of price ranges for little cigars. These are five popular brands on the chart. The Swisher Sweets, which were held up, is the first one. The Mini Cigarellos, which I held up. And then you have Primetime, Remington, and Cheyenne, and those products were here as well. The wholesale cost of those products is on the top line. Remember, wholesalers currently then apply a 70% tax, but that's two components. One, the 35% excise tax, and then a 35% health impact fee. So that's the 70%. You see in the second line what that 70% equals. For example, Swisher Sweets, it's $1.58. Then we have the suggested retail price. So then we calculate the sales tax on each of those. So if you add up the 70% plus the sales tax, you get the amount in the line third from the bottom. The cigarette tax stamp amount is $1.576. That's 48 cents excise tax, 75 cents health impact fee, and 34.6 cents sales tax. So the cigarette tax has the sales tax built in. But when you do the math, when you look at the 70% and subtract what the cigarette tax is, you have losses and you have gains. On some of the most popular products, like the Swishers, you're going to lose money. That's the Swisher Sweets. You're going to lose $3.60 a carton in tax revenue. These, you're going to lose $1.91 per pack in tax revenue. The Prime Times, you're going to lose $4.40 a carton. But you will make it up on some other products. Remington, you're going to make $10.40 a carton. Cheyenne, you're going to make $7.90 a carton. Here's the problem with the ones you're going to make revenue on. Currently, you can go online. I did this morning before coming over. You can buy Remington's online, little cigars, from B&B Tobacco. You can buy Cheyenne's from the same company, B&B Tobacco. The Remington's are $8.99 a carton. That is a $20 difference when you add on the extra tax here. Consumers can go online and order these. They can get them delivered to their mailbox by the postman. Federal law was changed last July. It prohibited the mail service, the postal service, from delivering cigarettes or smokeless tobacco through the U.S. mail. It didn't include cigars. So for those low-income consumers who are the significant consumers of these very low-priced little cigars want to still retain the ability to obtain that product, they go online and purchase it for $20 or less than a carton than they could here in Minnesota. And they get it delivered to their mailbox because there's no prohibition against the mailman delivering it. UPS, DHL, FedEx, they won't deliver these anymore because they can't ensure a minor is not at the door when the product is delivered. Cheyenne, you can buy them for $14 a carton. $18 less than what this new tax would be. So what this bill does, there's revenue gains and revenue losses. There's tax increases and tax decreases. We don't support the bill because we can't stamp over half the products. We won't sell those products. We'll lose sales. Retailers lose sales. And the state will lose tax revenue. Consumers can go elsewhere for the same product at much less expense. So there's significant issues here that we hope you consider. And if I have any questions, I'd be glad to answer those.
Mr. Bryant?
Yes.
Are there manufacturers that only manufacture these types of little cigars?
Madam Chair, I may defer to Mr. Holton. He represents the Cigar Association of America. He might be better able to answer that. I'm not sure.
All right. Then about your comments specifically, you said that there's an effective prohibition on certain types of products because they can't be stamped efficiently in your business.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
My question is, wouldn't those customers migrate to just a different product? Because it seems like there are so many similar products. I'm not aware of them all. I'm not a smoker, but just by seeing what's been passed around, it seems like there are so many options that would seem that it's not a prohibition, but maybe would be a deferral to another type of product that could be stamped.
Madam Chair, I think the purpose of the bill is to try and reduce youth smoking of little cigars. Since so few youth use little cigars, I don't think that goal is going to be reached. Consumers are price sensitive and somewhat brand loyal. If they are too price sensitive, they will shift to a different product. But that doesn't reduce smoking, which is the overall goal of this. And that's what I have a hard time grasping. If the goal is to reduce smoking, how does changing the way the product is taxed reduce smoking when some products become cheaper and some more expensive? They will simply shift and continue smoking a different brand. That's a very good possibility, yes.
Well, Mr. Bryant, that might be someone else's goal here. I'm not sure it's my primary goal. It's an important one. But my goal is consistency in the tax policies in the state of Minnesota. And so if you would address your comments to that, yeah, I would appreciate it. Others may want to hear your comments about the other goals. But for me, this bill is of significant importance because it seems to me inconsistent in our tax policy. So what I'm asking is, would there not be migration to other products if you can't efficiently affix this stamp to the product?
Madam Chair, there are other manufacturers who do provide little cigar products, and they may choose to purchase those little cigar products. That may or may not affect the tax that the state is collecting. The current 70% tax system works well. It isn't broke. Cigars are taxed differently because they're not cigarettes. The tobacco, as Mr. Holton will explain, is very different from the tobacco used in cigarettes. If you're talking about a migration from little cigars to cigarettes, that may not happen because the tobacco is very different. It's a different kind of smoke. I've never smoked, but I'm told it's a very different kind of product to smoke, and they may choose to stay with little cigars. If they do, that may or may not impact tax revenue because there'll be price declines and price increases.
Mr. Holton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Court Holton, and I represent the Cigar Association of America, which represents most of the cigar manufacturers in the world. I've been on this issue for a long time. This year, it's back. I expected it to be back. We had a big bill last year, a bill that actually passed. It did a lot of things in the tobacco world, and I worked with some of the authors of that bill, not with the advocates because we don't hardly ever talk to each other, but most of that bill passed, and it did a lot of different things. And as I looked at and discovered some of the products that were out there, we actually agreed that a lot of that bill made sense, and it passed. Little cigar provision that's before you now was part of that bill. And after being fleshed out, several hearings and a lot of discussions, the legislature rejected that provision because it didn't make any sense. This is a classic example of trying to fix something that isn't broke. At least it isn't broke in the sense that you're being told that it's broke. If you pass this bill, a lot of stuff will be broke. You heard about this. The manufacturers that I represent will basically have to pull their product from Minnesota, but not all manufacturers. You talked about moving to another product. They'll move to another manufacturer because there will be survivors under this bill, and they will get all of the market share. And I don't think that it's the business of government to to dictate who gets what market share. I think that should be a consumer choice, which brings us to my next topic. Young people smoking cigars. Absolute fantasy. You can take a look at the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, and you will find that there's been no increase in cigar smoking by young people. Cigars are not marketed to young people. They're marketed to the consumers that are inclined to buy cigar products, and they are a lot older than young people and primarily male. Is a little cigar a cigarette? I can answer that in two ways. Cigarettes are primarily flue-cured tobaccos, mostly acidic. They are smoother in taste. They have higher sugar content. All of those things go into the smoking experience, I guess, and they're wrapped in white paper. Cigars are air-cured or fermented cigar tobaccos with a stronger taste and a lower sugar content. They are primarily alkaline. Cigarettes, I said alkaline, I meant acidic. And they're wrapped in either natural tobacco leaf or another product that is two-thirds tobacco leaf and one-third reconstituted paper. What does all that mean? It means it attracts a different consumer. If you want to know whether cigarettes are and little cigars are the same thing, you could take my word for it. Maybe you don't want to do that. Here's the real test. What are the consumers purchasing? If little cigars were the same thing as cigarettes, you would think that there would be some parity in consumption. Let me tell you what the consumption is. In the United States, the cigarette industry sells in 2 days what all of the little cigar manufacturers sell in an entire year. Now, that one fact alone should tell you that in addition to the chemical distinctions that I gave you, there is a true distinction in these products because the consumers decide with their money. This is the tax committee, and the chairman admonished us to talk about tax. So this isn't a comfortable discussion for me because this happened on my watch. But under my guardianship, we have altered the tax law in Minnesota so that cigars now pay twice the tax that cigarettes pay based on a dollar of product sold. I don't put that on my resume, but that is the situation that we're in. A package of cigarettes cost $5 or something like that. I'm looking at this chart that was put together by the wholesale manufacturers. Swisher Sweets, about $6. Swisher Cigarillos, about $6.60. They're already more expensive. Now, there are other products, and Senator Rosen and her and the advocates may be right about these other products. If you have that that sheet that Tom Bryant put out, the last two, something called Remington and something called Cheyenne. I'm looking at the wholesale cost of these products, and I'm kind of stunned and mystified. But those, I don't know who manufactures those. I've been told one of them is manufactured by the son of one of the richest people in the world. are not members of the Cigar Association. The prices are hard to understand. My question is, what's in them? Because it's inconceivable to me that you can put real cigar tobacco in a product like that and put a wholesale price of 57 cents on it. So that might be interesting to look at. But tax-wise, we are taxed twice what cigarettes are. The consumership of this is a very small portion of the public, of the smoking public. So if you get figures like 27% increase or something like that, you're talking about 20% of a very small marketplace. They make many different types and styles and packaging because somehow that is accepted by the consumers that use this product. If we do what we're going to do, it has no impact on young people smoking because they're smoking cigarettes, because cigarettes are cool. It'll have no impact on people smoking little cigars because they'll move to another manufacturer. And tax-wise, for those who survive, I guess, their tax will go down. We have done a lot of good things in Minnesota over the years. People like Senator Rosen and her predecessors, and it's in the figures, in the consumption figures, all of the things that Minnesota has done, you know, they basically have been worked out in this legislature. Most of them have made sense. This is not an example of one of those things that makes sense. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Holton. I have to say that I couldn't agree more that we should not be deciding market share in the tax committee or at the state capitol. However, I'm not sure we're not already doing that by the way we have set up the exemptions by exempting these little cigars. I'm having a really hard time looking at these two different products and saying there really are different products. And so I think you've got some work to do and to convince me that these really are different products appealing to a different share of the market. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm probably not going to be very popular here, with all due respect to Senator Rosen and Senator Nelson. I'm going to try and restrict my comments to the Tax Committee because I heard a lot of testimony about what maybe should have been before the Health Committee. Are cigarettes and cigars and any tobacco product, are they taxed the same rate as any other legal consumer product?
Mr. Bryant, do you want to address that?
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, no. It's our understanding they're probably taxed at the highest rate of any other consumer product, even including alcohol.
Madam Chair?
Senator
Thank
Hoffman.
You, Madam Chair. And so if we're sitting before a tax committee and we're talking about uniformity in tax law for a legal consumer product, where the state should not be dictating who gets what market share and whose behavior gets modified, I have no problem taxing these consumer products if that's our tax policy. Where I have a problem is if we're taxing things to change behavior. And I didn't hear any compelling testimony today from the former testifiers that would make me believe that raising a tax on this is going to bring us into uniformity with the rest of the legal consumer products that we sell in the state of Minnesota. What I heard a lot of testimony was about changing behavior. And if that's the case, then I don't think that that's the role of the tax committee or the state government. And on those basis, I will oppose these bills just on that. I don't agree with sin taxes. We live in a free country, and we have personal choice. And with those choices come consequences. Mm-hmm. And for the record, I am an ex-smoker. It's been 28 years, so I don't pay attention to how much these things cost. And I do talk to kids and everybody around me that I know is smoking because I know how harmful it is. I'm also a registered nurse. But we're talking about tax policy here. So if we're going to have a tax policy, it needs to be uniform across all legal consumer products. That's my comment.
Other members, Senator Howe?
Madam Chair, well, I think the Tax Committee, when we do look at taxes, we are looking to drive behavior regardless whether it's with corporate taxes, business taxes, or personal income taxes. I mean, we are going to drive behavior. I guess I have a little different question. I see in one of the handouts here that 8 other states do this, but I'd like to see, I don't know if someone has a chart of all the states, the 50 states, and the various ways these different products are taxed, because I'm more concerned that we have tax conformity to similar states, or what the trend is where most people are going with this in other states and how they tax these items. So I don't know if you do have a chart on that or not.
Sure, Senator Howe, we can get you some information. Do you, Senator Rosen next, and then Mr. Bryant or Mr. Holton? Senator
Thank
Rosen.
You. Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, there's 13 states and the federal government have moved to treat little cigars as 14. Cigarettes in their taxation. And I think Mr. Bryant was talking about that there are seven states that don't require the stamp, the tax stamp, and then five do. And I would like to bring Ms. Mullinan back up to address Senator Hoffman's comments on why we're having this issue with the taxes, because the little cigars, the statute says 297F.05, that cigarettes weighing no more than 3 pounds per thousand are taxed at a level. And then we're in this bill, we're taking it to 4.5 pounds or less per thousand. And so the little cigar manufacturers have then adjusted their weights to be just above the 3 pounds so they can be taxed at that level. But she can verify that and talk about that little more, along with the fact that Mr. Holton was talking about there has been no survey or no direct facts that little cigars have increased or they're being directed towards youth, and that's because the survey from the CDC does not address little cigars. It's addressing cigarettes and cigars. So they fell between the cracks here. And I will take I will argue the fact that these are being marketed to youth. Why would there be a strawberry and a chocolate a little cigar floating around? I certainly, Madam Chair, if you smoked, you probably would not pick up a chocolate little cigar. I mean, who are we addressing this marketing to? So obviously it is being marketed to our youth, and we have
more likely
to
go for the chocolate than the non.
Well, if you gave it up for Lent, then we're in trouble. But so there, that's a very, a lame argument that they're not being addressed towards youth. I think they absolutely are. So at some point I would like to have Ms. Mullinan back up to address some of these issues, specifically Senator Hoffman's.
All right, and Mr. Holton, did you want to address
Thank
that?
You, Madam Chairman. A couple of things on your statement on the being unconvinced on the difference. I can show you the sales stats. That's one thing. That's hard evidence. The other thing, if you were a smoker, which you're not, I could bring you a Swisher and a Marlboro, and you would be able to know what we're talking about. I don't suggest that, though. On the flavorings, little cigars have been around since the day of the movies that Clint Eastwood used to make in the Sergio, whatever, the Italian spaghetti western director. For 100 years, there's been flavoring in cigars. And it tries to follow them. But that's been around for, if you read that article in the Strib a couple of weeks ago, you'd think that this is something that was just hatched up to go after little kids. Little kids are not the market of cigars. For somebody who represents the industry or is in the industry, these conversations are like, what planet are these? I mean, this is just not reality. And the sales statistics, if that's all we have to go by, we'll bear that out. There was another question, and I forgot it. Did you?
Mr. Bryant.
Our taxes for cigars in Minnesota are in the stratosphere around the United States. There's like two or three other states. I think Washington and maybe Pennsylvania, although one of them dropped their tax substantially because they lost tax revenue when they went up to the zenith.
Thank you. Mr. Bryant, something to add on that?
Madam Chair, to Senator Howe's question, I have a couple copies of a chart which shows the state taxation for all 50 states on little cigars. 3/4 use a percent of wholesale price, and those percentages are all different. And then 12 tax like a cigarette, and even those rates are different. But I have a couple copies. I can certainly give one to Senator Howe and one to the chair, so you see those differences.
Thank you. And Mr. Holton, you mentioned some sales statistics. If you would just drop them by my office, I'd be very interested in to see how this market share compares, who you're selling to, I'm not necessarily concerned about the age demographics for purposes of the behavioral change, but are we really talking about separate market shares? I'd really like to see that.
Okay.
Senator Rosen.
And Madam Chair, to that, and this came from the American Cancer Society, the consumption of little cigars has climbed since 1998, but 104%, 154% since 1998. And went from production in 1997 to 2007 from 1.5 billion to 5.5 billion. So we are looking for some tax conformity because obviously the market and the manufacturers have adjusted the weight of this little cigar to fall under the lower tax structure so they don't have to pay for something that obviously looks, smokes, and inhales just like cigarettes.
Thank you. Madam Senator Huffman, do you have a follow-up to your previous question?
I do. I kind of want to follow up on Senator Howell's, thank you, Madam Chair, on Senator Howell's point about in our tax policy we do drive behavior. So then we go on to the bigger discussion of is that what tax policy is for, or is tax policy to fund the core functions of government? I'm one of those people that believes it's to fund the core function of government and not to drive the behavior of people in a free country.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rosen, you talked about flavoring and cigars, but I just have to make a comment. I'm wondering if we followed the premise that putting in flavor into a cigar would encourage young people to smoke, then why wouldn't the industry flavor cigarettes? I've never seen a flavored cigarette yet, other than
Madam
a menthol
Chair.
Brand. And
Senator Limmer, I don't think you're a smoker, but Senator
Madam
Rosen,
Chair, I believe, and I will have this confirmed, but I believe the federal government banned flavors in cigarettes. So
all
that
right.
is, yeah.
Okay.
And
well, Mr. Holton may know that. Do they do flavorings, or Mr. Bryant, do cigarettes get marketed with flavorings other than that menthol flavor?
Menthol.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, the new FDA tobacco regulations enacted in June of 2009 banned all flavorings in cigarettes except menthol or tobacco, true tobacco flavors. The chief flavoring in most cigarettes would be menthol. It's kind of a mint or kind of wintergreen flavor. That is still allowed, but that's generally the only flavor that's used because of the new federal regulation. But most cigarettes, you know, don't, but they do use menthol.
Mr. Bryant, prior to that, did they flavor cigarettes?
Madam Chair, yes, there were some brands that did include flavors, but you know, the national manufacturers generally did not include flavors. It was more smaller manufacturers that included flavored cigarettes.
Senator Limmer?
Moving on, I'm trying to recall, and maybe I wasn't here then, but why did the small cigar type products become omitted from the tax policy on everything else? I heard a comment by the proponents that said, oh, it just fell through the cracks. Well, I remember whenever you tax tobacco, it is a very detailed and arduous discussion. I would find it unusual for people who want to tax tobacco products to leave anything off the table and allow it to fall through the cracks. And was there a purposeful intent of the legislature to leave that tax off this product? And I don't recall, does anyone recall what the logic or reasoning was?
Mr. Holton and then Senator Rosen.
Excuse me, Madam Chairman, Senator Limmer, which tax are you referring to?
Well,
Senator Limmer.
We're given this representation that cigarette pack is $4.50 and a little cigar package is only $1.79. And so is that the difference? Does that difference represent nearly $2.80 of taxes? I would imagine government gets more in revenue than the tobacco company gets in profit. Much like gasoline. Government taxes everything to the point that government gets more for the product than what the manufacturer gets. So I'm just wondering, going back to the original premise of how we got here in the first place, why is there an omission on taxes, and why wasn't it caught earlier when we were raising taxes?
Mr. Holton.
Madam Chairman, Senator Limmer, okay, I understand your question now, and I would love to be able to brag about having been able to maneuver through the cracks at least at one point in my career at the legislature. It has never happened. We have been smacked every time there's been a tax increase, even though we pay more taxes than the cigarette product that you were comparing to. For instance, a 20-count carton of $20 cigars at wholesale is $400. The state tax on that is $140 on one carton. $140. We pay 70%. Now, that's based on wholesale price. So, for instance, on this chart we showed you, I think a cigarette pack is approaching a buck and a half when you add up everything. These Swishers are $1.68. The difference is the wholesale price. So you could get lower than a cigarette pack tax if you made a product that was way, way low in price, so low that 70% of it would not add up to a buck and a half. There's almost nothing out there except possibly these two products that Mr. Bryant has discovered. But answer your questions, no, we've never escaped the tax whack. I've tried.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, and I think I really would like to bring Ms. Mullen in, I cannot say your name, up to address this because it really does come down to the pounds and to the way the tax structure has been to date. And it has. This has been a loophole. These little scars has been a loophole in the tax structure. So if we could.
Thank you. Ms. Moylan, and very briefly, we're getting to the end of, I think, what is a very important discussion about this issue.
I do want to take a moment just to address some of the other questions that came up because I feel like I have some data that would support that. First of all, I just wanted to reference the National Survey on Drug Use and Health that the previous testifier referred to. What that study shows is that while cigarette consumption among youth has been in decline, cigar consumption has remained steady. So he is right that it hasn't gone up, but it hasn't gone down consistently with cigarettes. So I just wanted to point that out from that study. I also wanted to just touch base on the tax stamping as well. You know, there are a number of different size packs of cigarettes, which we heard about. We have this size, this pack here. These are all different size, wides, and they all have to be tax stamped. So stamping machines already accommodate various shapes and sizes. In the case of the products that don't fit through the high-speed machines, they can be hand-stamped. Wholesalers have been hand-stamping for a long time, and it's a part of their cost of doing business. So while the vast majority of little cigars come in exactly the same size and shape as cigarettes in the packs, the few that don't, just like the few cigarettes that don't, will need to be hand-stamped. In terms of the question about the pounds, it is true that, you know, I want to remind us that there is a loophole in this law, and the loophole has allowed these manufacturers to evade proper taxation over time. And when we set the weight, that is because they're able to manipulate the weight. And so we have really worked in the interim to make sure that our definition will capture the products that we intend to and not those that we don't. In some cases where there might be a product that is questionable, we'll need to say if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, then call it a duck. And we'll make some calls on that. Now, in terms of the question about tax conformity, I'd say again, these are products that, for all intents and purposes, are marketed as cigarettes. They are experienced by the consumer as cigarettes. I can't tell you what's in the makeup of the cigarette itself, but I can tell you how it's experienced, marketed, packages, and sold is as cigarettes. and therefore to meet that tax compliance, to meet that tax conformity standard that Senator Hoffman brought up, it should be taxed like the similar product that it is, a cigarette.
Thank you, Ms. Mullen. And Mr. Bryant, a final comment.
Madam Chair, regarding the stamping, I want to clarify a couple things on these examples here.
Very briefly,
yes,
sir.
Yes, the one on your right, the purple one, that is put into a special size carton with styrofoam inserts, so it is still the same size as a regular carton of cigarettes. It can be machine stamped. These higher ones, remember, the machines can be adjusted for height. It's the same width, same depth. It's the depth that's key. The wides, the same depth. We can stamp those. The Dunhills that are in the middle, there are a couple of cigarette brands we can't stamp by the machine. That is one of them, but it is the exception to the rule. There are a couple hundred little cigar brands that we can't machine stamp. They will not be stamped by hand. They will not be sold in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Senator Sundrum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have to, I've just got to kind of unfold this, at least for myself, because it seems like I'm hearing testimony that says that, you know, this is kind of, that they're both kind of taxed a lot. Mr. Holton said cigars are taxed a lot. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, are these things taxed on par with each other? Because it seems to me that one side saying they're not and the other side saying they're, at least the cigars are taxed a lot. I don't know if it's taxed equal to a cigarette or not, but that's my question, just so basic. I mean, what is the difference between taxes on what I'm holding in my hands?
Senator Sundrum, that is Senator Rosen and Senator Nelson's point. That's what they're saying, is there is a distinction in our tax code for those two products if you can distinguish the products. Senator
but
Nelson,
Madam
did
Chair,
you want to answer the
Mr.
question?
Holton kind of indicated that cigars are taxed almost in an all-world way. I mean, that they're taxed pretty high as well, and that's where I'm having confusion or problems.
Senator Nelson, do you want to address that point?
Yes. Senator Sundrum, you have made our point exactly. These two things look alike. They are used in the same manner, and they are taxed differently. And all that my Senate file and Senator Rosen's Senate file is doing is we are simply asking this tax committee to tax these same items the same. And there is really no difference except the color. So most of us would look at this and we'd say it's a brown cigarette. And that's all we're asking this committee to do. I understand Senator Hoffman's concern about tax philosophy, and I don't think that's the point of this bill at all. And I agree with Senator Limmer. I don't like these things where it seems like most of my bill is taxes, like my phone bill. It seems to be more taxes than actually phone service sometimes. But really, the point of this is just uniformity and consistency. They are the same product, a different color, and they are marketed the same. They are used in the same manner, and the cost is so different. And quite frankly, our tax policy is allowing that to happen. We ought not be doing that. They should be taxed exactly the same.
Senator Sundrum.
But where I'm confused, this was told, I don't know if it's a swisher or not, but it was presented to be a swisher. It says on here a swisher in this pack is $1.58. What would be a pack of Camels taxed at?
Mr. Bryant?
Madam Chair, Senator Sundrum, the cigarettes are taxed at $1.576 per pack. That includes the sales tax of 34.6 cents. So a pack of cigarettes with excise tax alone is $1.23 per pack of 20 cigarettes, plus the 34.6 cents in sales tax gets you to $1.576.
So, Mr. Bryant, he's asking what's the tax on the little cigar?
Madam Chair, Senator Sundrum, because the tax on cigars is based on a 70% of the wholesale price, and because the wholesale price is across a broad range, the tax amount is different. That's why I gave you the chart to show some are higher priced, higher taxes. Some are lower priced, lower taxes. But it's still 70% across the board on the wholesale price.
But, Madam Chair,
Senator Sundrum,
Mr. Bryant, at least on the swishers, it looks to me that at 2 1/4 a pack is $1.58 of tax on this thing, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Sundrum, yes, for excise tax, it's $1.58. That's correct, per pack. Then you have to add on the sales tax of another, 40-some cents, I think, on the chart to show apples-to-apples comparison to cigarettes.
So, Madam Chair, I'm beginning Senator to think that these are kind of taxed at about the same rate. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, Senator Sundrum, the revenue estimate suggests that if you do tax the little cigars differently, it does actually raise a bit more in tax. I'm guessing it's an extremely small amount per cigarette or per pack, but overall on the part of the state, it does raise, you know, $2.7 million in 2012.
Madam Chair, I'm still confused a little bit, but I'll ride along.
Senator Sundrum, I think we all still have some questions about this, and hopefully we can have those questions addressed outside of the committee because we are going to end this hearing on this bill. We have other bills up. Senator Nelson or Senator Rosen, the final word.
Madam Chair, I'm going to actually defer to Ms. I already gave my comments, but Ms. Moylan has an answer.
Ms. Moylan, to that exact point, very briefly.
That I just wanted to say that the wholesale price, it depends where it starts at. And while the fiscal note, while the revenue estimate is in the positive, is because the vast majority of these products are deep discount. So they start out at less than a dollar a pack. So that is where the significant difference comes into play. And final words, I would just say that, again, this bill is about making the health of our kids in Minnesota a priority, creating stability and uniformity.
Thank you, Ms. Moylan. And we will take Senate File 450 under for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam
Thank
Chair.
You all for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Reinert and Senator Miller, are they both here? Senator Miller here? Senator Reinert, if we could wait until Senator Miller comes, and maybe in the meantime we could have Senator Chamberlain. Are your folks here?
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Chamberlain?
Madam Chair, I do have a bill up with some people here, too.
Yeah, oh, you do, Senator?
She has another bill.
Oh, I'm sorry, the personal property
yes,
tax?
Thank you.
Go ahead. Thank you.
If I could. Since I'm here, Senate File 450, Madam Chair, is a bill and members to exempt the machinery and personal property of a new natural gas electric generation facility. So it's very tightly crafted, this bill, Madam Chair, and it's exclusively for a 20 to 30 megawatt, which is somewhat.
We can't hear Senator Rosen, so I'd ask you to please take your comments and your conversations outside. Senator Rosen, I'm sorry. Please proceed.
That's okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So it's for a new natural gas electric generation facility, tightly crafted for a 20 to 30 megawatt, which is kind of rare because most of these combustion turbines are about 300 megawatts. It's got to be owned by a municipal power agency located within 1 mile of an existing natural gas pipeline. And the facility must satisfy a resource deficiency, which is identified in an approved integrated resource plan. And it also must have approval of a city and both the city and the county. And there was a referendum that was passed in November for this. And with me, Madam Chair, I have Larry Johnston from the Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, SMPA.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Larry Johnston with Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, or SMPA as we're known, is a not-for-profit wholesale generation and transmission company created by the member municipalities that own us. We serve 18 member utilities throughout the state of Minnesota. I might mention that among those 18 utilities are the City of Fairmont, which is in Senator Rosen's district, and the City of Rochester, which is in Senator Sinjum's district. As Senator Rosen pointed out, it's about a 25-megawatt natural gas engine plant. We've been looking at ways to meet the electrical needs of our member communities, and this is a very efficient plant for us to put in place. Not only will it help us meet the needs of our member communities on a daily basis in working in the MISO market, but it does provide some extra advantages for the City of Fairmont in the event that there was an emergency that isolated them from the transmission system. We could, in fact, provide electricity to the City of Fairmont. The facility is going to be built on the site of the existing power plant in the City of Fairmont, so it provides us an opportunity to take that brownfield site and kind of refurbish that as well as provide some employment in the community. We hope to close on that property at the end of this month. So what we're requesting of you today in this bill is an exemption from the personal property tax associated with that facility. Over the past 20 25 years in the state of Minnesota, there's probably been two dozen of these sorts of requests for generation facilities that have been brought forward. We do have the support of the city and the county. Last fall, we had a referendum, actually. Fairmont took kind of an extra step with this in terms of looking at doing this project, and it received approval with 85% of the vote in that referendum. Within this past week, we have received unanimous resolutions from the city of Fairmont and from Martin County supporting the project and supporting the personal property tax exemption. I would point out that there are no fiscal implications for the state with regard to this bill, and we thank you for your consideration. Be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Dr. Johnston, it sounds like you've done your work and you have a lot of support in your community for this. Is there anyone here that might like to testify either in favor or against this proposal? Senator Howell?
Madam Chair, can you tell me, when they say there's no fiscal implications going forward, I don't know whether any of those counties or cities get LGA dollars currently, but that could be a factor in it. Could you tell me what do you know what the proposed taxes that the actual facility with this upgrade is going to be subject to with this personal exemption, and then what would be the difference without the personal? And if you could just go a little bit further on is it a case where you can't build this without the exemption, or that the electricity that would be generated from it would be too costly if you didn't have the exemption? So if you could get me those numbers, that would be helpful.
Senator Howe, that was more than one question. Mr. Johnston, wherever you'd like to begin with that.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, yeah, there's a couple questions there. With regard to, I think, your most straightforward question in that area is, you know, what is the value at the moment? We don't have that number determined yet. One of the issues with the whole personal property tax in terms of valuing that is ultimately, you know, getting the machinery and equipment that's involved in the facility and working with a local assessor in establishing what that value is. I guess the best way I can deal with that concept, I guess, at the moment is that, again, you know, this is a we're a not-for-profit entity owned by the member communities that in fact we serve, and those communities and their county understanding the potential project made the comment that they're fully in support of the exemption with regard to this piece of property. A couple extenuating things there is that, again, we're refurbishing a existing plant site, and so we will be paying in lieu of real estate taxes with regard to that on a site that currently doesn't have any taxes assessed on it. So I'm sure that went into their thinking and the consideration with regard to that as well. To your second question, there's significant rate pressure in the state of Minnesota. Right. And our initial look at this was, you know, we've seen 20, 25 years worth of exemptions for gas plants go forward. It would seem like if we weren't looking at the consumers that we serve and requesting such an exemption, that has the potential to economically disenfranchise them versus other electric supply.
Madam Chair, just to follow
Senator
up,
Howell.
I know I had many questions. I didn't get an answer. That's what I was looking for, was an answer. But I just think I need to know the numbers when we look at what, you know, maybe you could just tell me the percentage of this exemption. What percentage of this project would be exempt? Would it be 35%? Would it be 85% of the actual value of this project? Maybe that would be a simpler question.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Mr. Johnston.
Senator Howell. That is easier number for me to get at. This is about a $30 million project in total in terms of the capital investment. The estimate at the moment is that about $15 million of that might be classified as personal property. Another $2 million of that might be classified as pollution control equipment.
Thank you. Okay. Other Thank questions you. From members? Senator Rosen, final comments?
No, I think those are great questions, Madam Chair, and you all have the from the Department of Revenue, the fiscal note here, so I'm not sure what your wish is with this, Madam Chair. Are you ready to pass it on or have it in your bill?
I am.
Possible inclusion?
Yep. Without further objection, the chair would like to lay over Senate File 450 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnston,
Chair,
thank you for being here. We have Senators Reinert and Miller who are here, and they would like to talk about tax reciprocity with the state of Wisconsin, and then following that we'll have Senator Senjum and Senator Chamberlain. We did have the hearing scheduled till 11, or right up until session this morning to accommodate all these bills. Senator Miller and Senator Reinert, would you like to begin, please? Yep.
Thank you.
Senator Reinert, you were here before on this bill. Do you want to just give us an update on the status of your work?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to invite Mr. Innes to the table, too, if that's okay with the chair.
Thank you. And, Senator Reinert, we have an amendment that you want us to offer today.
You want to take that first, Madam Chair?
If you would just remind members of where you're at with the bill in its current form and what your amendment would do, that would help.
Sure. So, again, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. This bill is a bill that would redo the income tax reciprocity benchmark study. That's the study that we use the data from to reuse the data from past tense for the reciprocity agreement with Wisconsin. When the as the agreement was being undone, as it were, then Commissioner Innes and I said, you know, we want to see this come back at some point, and step one is to redo the study. To have current data. The data in the old study was nearly 40 years old. So this would call for a new study. The amendment that I have would do two things. Number one, it would just update a couple dates because I had this bill in last year. It didn't get done. It actually passed both the House and Senate but died in conference committee. So two minor things, changing 2010 to 2011, 2012 to 2013, just to get the dates in the right order. And then the other thing that the amendment does is bring this into close alignment with the House version. This bill has had a hearing in the House Tax Committee chaired by Representative Davids. He added that language to his bill. He's the chief author of the bill in the House. He added that language. It's language I'm comfortable with. So those are the two things that the amendment would do, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Reinert. Senator Chamberlain would move the A2 amendment. Senator Chamberlain, are you okay with that? Senator Chamberlain moves the adoption of the A2 amendment. Any comments or questions about the A2? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Thank you, Senator Reinert. Former Commissioner Innes is here. Mr. Innes, would you like to comment on this bill?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ward Innes, and I'm here in my former capacity as a revenue employee who was responsible for actually terminating the reciprocity agreement. You know, I think Senator Reinert's bill is an absolute prerequisite to entering into a new agreement that will benefit both states. As he stated, the current benchmark study is antiquated. There's been a longstanding dispute between the two states about the appropriate number of people that are crossing over the border each year, whether the reimbursement is adequate under the agreement. And this predates the Plenty administration. I know there was a dust-up during the Wendy Anderson administration that was never resolved. I know that when Senator Pogamiller was a tax chair, there was some controversy between Wisconsin and Minnesota regarding this issue, and Senator Pogamiller was instrumental in at least getting interest paid on the delayed payment dates. And so I think this is, if reciprocity is going to come back, I think many people believe it should come back. Most people have worked their entire careers under a reciprocity agreement. They've crossed back and forth between the two states. For the most part, it's worked. I think these issues need to be resolved, though. Unfortunately, we couldn't resolve them in the time frame in 2009. And the study is absolutely a prerequisite. I think both states recognize that it needs to be done at some point. And hopefully down the road, once that study is completed, the reciprocity agreement can be reinstated. And for really, I mean, I know you're not in Senator Miller's bill right now, but Senator Miller's bill pretty much was our negotiating position. We wanted to be reimbursed in the same fiscal year in which we incurred the revenue loss. We were never able to reach that compromise with Wisconsin. So I give Senator Miller a lot of credit. His bill pretty much codifies into law the position that the Department of Revenue took back in 2009.
Thank you. And we will get to Senator Miller's bill. Is there any question about Senator Reinert's proposal for a study here? Anyone here to testify for or against that proposal? All right, then. Senator Miller, do you want to just talk about your bill?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm not going to go into detail about income tax reciprocity, but
We do have an amendment, I think, that we're going to pass out to bring this bill into current form to match the House version. And as much as I'd like to take the credit for this bill, I can't do that. I've been working with Representative Davids in the House and Senator Reinhart, and it's been a collaborative effort. So it's not I certainly don't want to take the credit. They've been doing a lot of work on this as well. But basically, what the amended version of the bill, or can we want to move the amendment first?
You have an A1 amendment?
Yes.
Senator Miller, do you want to just explain what the amendment would do?
Sure. Well, the amendment just brings the bill into current form and matches the House version. And what this would do is it requires the state of Minnesota and the state of Wisconsin to come up with an agreement, and it basically would make the state of Wisconsin make one or more estimated payments to the state of Minnesota in the fiscal year which the revenue loss occurred, and then a final payment in the following year. What we've seen is this has been drawn out fiscal year, and that's what's created the problem that we had before we removed this agreement. So the other thing this would do is it revokes the authority from the Commissioner of Revenue to terminate the agreement and gives that power to the legislature. So it would have to be Minnesota law or Wisconsin law to terminate the agreement, not the authority of the governor or the Department of Revenue. And it applies interest to the final payment, but not to the estimated payments.
So, Senator Miller, would this then create or authorize specific terms for the agreement on the part of the state of Minnesota? Obviously, we can't reach an agreement by Minnesota law, but we can authorize the negotiation under certain terms with Wisconsin so that they don't have to come back for later authorization from the legislature? And maybe council can help out. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Pollack. Okay, Senator Chamberlain would offer the A1 amendment, and as a courtesy to the author, I hope members will support this amendment. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The A1 is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I have a map here just to give folks a perspective, if we can get this passed out. What this basically shows the border counties in the state and how they're affected. And Houston County, which is in the southeastern most county in the state of Minnesota, is the number one county affected by this. And then St. Louis County is the second county most affected by this. So this just gives folks a good perspective, a good visual on how the counties, the border counties in the state of Minnesota are affected. And I just want to read an email that I received from a constituent that lives in Houston County. Dear Senator Miller, I reside in La Crescent, Minnesota, and work in Wisconsin. With the loss of reciprocity, I just finished filing my taxes in Wisconsin and Minnesota. The net result to me was paying an additional $1,800 in individual income tax as compared to just filing in Minnesota. While Wisconsin claims that you are only taxed on your Wisconsin income, it turns out not to be a true statement. And while Minnesota claims to give you a credit for taxes you pay in Wisconsin against the income you had in Wisconsin, it turns out that Minnesota only credits a portion of the taxpayer money that they earned in Wisconsin. The reality is both states tax you on a portion of the same income. So that's just some of the feedback that we're getting from the folks that are directly impacted by this issue.
Thank you, Senator Miller. Senator Michelle.
Madam Chair, maybe for council or any of the three at the table here, do I understand that the governor of Wisconsin just make some statements about this issue this week, or am I confused? confusing things.
Anyone have information on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, I'm not sure specifically on that. The state of Wisconsin does owe the state of Minnesota roughly $60 million, and we're collecting interest on that money every day. I did talk with Governor Dayton probably a month or so ago. He's supportive of our efforts. He does want to make sure that we get our $60 million, and I agree with him on that. And he was having discussions with Governor Walker in Wisconsin about that as well. But from what I heard, Governor Walker is, I mean, I think he has plans to pay this back in the near future.
Thank you. Members, I don't see these as inconsistent. I think they're very complementary proposals. Mm-hmm. I think they could proceed separately within the omnibus bill. And I thank you both for your work on this issue. The map really does help, Senator Miller. Thank you.
Thank you.
I do want to point out for Senator Reinert, there is expected to be a fiscal cost to your study. Have you received any information about the cost associated with the study?
Madam Chair, the fiscal note last year was approximately $300,000, and the fiscal note for this year just hasn't been completed yet. But I don't have any reason to suspect it would be substantially different a year later. So.
All right. Well, Senator Reinert, will you keep us updated on that as well?
That's right.
Thank you. Other members, questions or comments about these bills? Without objection, the chair would like to lay over Senate File 122 and Senate File 802 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Senjum, and then we'll have Senator Chamberlain. And if we're not too long, we'll have time for a quick cup of coffee before session. Senator Senjum, welcome to the committee.
Members, thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Senjum, before you do that, I just want to point out for the record that both of those files should proceed as amended. I forgot to say that they were amended here in committee, but both Senate File 802 and Senate File 122 were amended, and we have moved to lay them over for possible inclusion as amended. Senator Senjum, I'm sorry for the interruption. Please go ahead.
And Madam Chair, I think that they're handing out are they not handing out a new bill? As it was
Senator Senjum, we do have it, and it includes the first engrossment.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, may I offer the A1 amendment?
Senator Senjum, would you like to just explain what the amendment does for your bill?
Sure. Madam Chair and members, this amendment further, I think, codifies or at least establishes the eligibility of public school systems to this tax credit, which we're going to talk about. It's generally geared towards the private school system, but this would, I think, further establish that it would work in the public sector as well.
So, Senator Senjum, you're going to expand your bill to allow grants not just for private schools but also for public schools and provide that same tax credit?
Yes.
Thank you. Senator Chamberlain, are you willing to offer the A1 amendment at this time?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Comments or questions? Senator Pogemiller.
Just procedural matter. This is an engrossment, so this is passed a committee.
Correct.
And so this is not just an author's amendment. This is...
Senator Pogemiller, I understand this is a first engrossment. It is an amendment being offered in this committee. Senator Chamberlain has offered the amendment, but Senator Senjum can offer it. He's a member of the committee. So Senator Senjum moves. If you would withdraw your motion, Senator Chamberlain. Thank you. Senator Senjum, would you like to move the A1 amendment?
Madam Chair, and I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Thank you. Comments or questions, Senator Pogemiller?
Does it change the fiscal note?
Senator Senjum, do you have information as to whether this would change the fiscal note?
Yes, Madam Chair, and actually the action to the Education Committee the other day would change the fiscal note as well, as the fiscal note is built around a bill with caps on it. And this particular bill that we have before us at this moment does not have caps on it. So generally speaking, the revenue note, the fiscal note, is what it is, but it is built around a bill with caps on it. So conceivably, there would be more money coming into this system than is established or at least shown on the revenue note. And so that bill or that fiscal note, those numbers could actually get larger.
Senator Senjum, any indication as to the timing of the availability of the new fiscal note with this amendment? Any information that you can give us as to what this would do to the bill?
Madam Chair, I just got this note last night, so the answer is no. What I would also say, though, about the fiscal note is, and we don't do dynamic scoring, but then again, if we did, the conjecture is that if we did a program like this, that would be there would be, frankly, offset costs in that a number of people, students would be, perhaps, and low-income students would be moving from public schools to private schools, and thus there'd be a reduction in per-pupil aid.
Thank you, Senator Sundrum.
And, Madam Chair, that's been borne out in other states.
Thank you. Senator Pogemiller.
Madam Chair, the amendment is a education policy amendment. Was the amendment considered in the Education Committee?
Senator Sundrum.
Madam Chair, it was not. It was one that we were asked about and agreed to at the end of that hearing upon leaving the room.
Well, Senator Pogemiller.
And kind of what will be your thinking on that, bills that come from other committees? What will be your approach with regards to committee jurisdictions? Well, just an informational question.
Senator Pogemiller, is the first time I've been presented with that question. I think it's a good question. I would be interested to hear your advice on that.
Just want to know what the chair is going to do.
Senator Pogemiller, chair is not sure yet. Other members with questions or comments? Senator Sundrum has moved that the A1 be adopted. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, so Senator Sundrum, the fiscal note is with a cap on the program, and so the bill right now has no cap on, so the fiscal note could be much higher, and then adding public schools in effect, if a parent wants to, right now, if they give money to their kids' school is a donation, their school's foundation or whatever, they might get, whatever their tax bracket is, they'd get a deduction worth that much. If they're a 7.85% bracket, marginal tax rate, presumably they'd be get 7.85% of their contribution would be paid, and under this they'd have 80% of it paid?
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, that would be correct, yes.
Madam Chair, just a sense that just the bill without the caps period might be not in terms of $100 million a year, but more like twice that kind of thing, it seems to me. And then if you put public schools in, you might be talking real money. I'm just an observation, Madam Chair.
Senator Marty, I'd say we're already talking about very
I
real
would
money.
Say so too. I would
Senator,
say so too.
Senator Sundrum, if we adopt your amendment, what would you suggest to us we do with this bill? Are you suggesting that we carry this over for the tax bill, or would you like it sent back to the Education Committee for further consideration with your amendment?
Madam Chair, there was discussion at the Education Committee about things like in a public school setting, if the scholarship fund might pay for, as I think we all know, football fees, or you know, my child can't afford to be in the choir anymore because it's going to cost $100. There was discussion along those lines there, and I think generally feeling, or just generally speaking, there was I think heads nodding with respect to, you know, that's a good idea. I mean, we could certainly send it back, but I'm not sensing, at least based on those discussions, that the Education Committee would think that not including public schools it would be a bad idea. I think they generally think it was a good idea.
Senator Sundrum, is Senator Olson a co-author on this bill?
Madam Chair, she is.
That's what I thought. And have you consulted with her about this amendment?
No, we haven't. This is an overnight amendment.
Senator Sundrum, I would strongly suggest that you talk to Senator Olson about it. You know, you've made a motion here. You're a member of this committee.
Sure.
We can adopt this amendment if you have the votes here. But I would ask you to do that so that we build as much consensus around your proposal here as possible before we take final action on it in the Tax Committee. Senator Howell?
Madam Chair, I know I'm a freshman, but I was just going to make that same point. I think that we can move on the amendment, and if Senator Olson, who's the chair, wants to request it back, she certainly is the prerogative to do that, and I think Senator Sinjum would follow up with Senator Olson on that. We had a similar situation in another another committee where we're, you know, we're making changes and we're sending it on to another committee, but whether or not it needs to come back to the committee that we're at, knowing that there's going to be changes going forward, that chair just said, you know, if I need to have it back in front of my committee, I'll request it.
Senator. And, Madam Chair, I'm happy to do that. Absolutely happy to do that.
Senator Sinjum renews his motion to adopt the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I'll be...
We have someone from the Department of Revenue. I'm sorry, I don't remember your name, sir. Did you have a comment about the revenue note?
I had a comment about the bill.
All right. Well, we'll let Senator Sinjum just... make additional comments if you'd like to present the bill. And he also has a testifier here, Mr. Fields. But we will get back to you, sir. Senator Sinjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I'll be somewhat brief and turn it over to Mr. Fields, who actually, along with others, in a think tank kind of manner, adopted this bill, or at least put this bill together, albeit I would tell you states like New Jersey, Florida, Pennsylvania, Arizona, are all into this, and it seems to be a trendy thing. It's called the Equity and Opportunity Education Tax Credit Bill. Effectively, what it does, and it's directed towards low-income students in situations where those students might find themselves able to be more successful in another school setting, and in all likelihood, perhaps a private school setting, but for financial reasons, can't get there. I have found out, Madam Chair, since I got involved in this bill, that there is almost huge support by individuals who call saying, Dave, if this bill passes, I'm in, and I'm in substantially with the financial contributions to my local scholarship fund, because I want to help out, and especially with this 80% tax credit. It is it's a very appealing kind of situation. But so this is to give kids a chance to migrate into a different school system if they so choose. It, again, provides for an 80% tax credit. It's exciting when you kind of think about the dynamics. Although a big revenue note, I think the feeling is longer term, that cost would be offset by a lesser per pupil amount into our private or public education system being needed, and we tend to see scholarships paying for a lot of the private education.
Thank you.
And with that, I just, in the essence of time, maybe Mr. Fields can offer his testimony and certainly the Revenue Department.
Mr. Fields, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to come here. I won't give a long speech. This bill is basically, as Senator Sinjum says, it speaks to poverty families in Minnesota. For the private school part of that, the non-public school part of that, it makes the opportunity for the giver and the church. 98% of private schools are church-related, and the family to pay for the education instead of the state taxpayers. We did our own little fiscal write-up of that, but before that, I'd like to bring this to the attention of the committee. It's the Florida study that's been around. Well, this is the newest one, but it basically uses the same math that we did. If you look at page 2, it shows that for every student that ends up in the non-public school or stays in the non-public school because now they have a scholarship donor, it saves Florida $5,000 a kid. And so they had 21,000 kids in it. It saved the state of Florida $36 million for that. In Minnesota, I ran the numbers, and it saves $3,700 a kid who stays in the system or transfers to the non-public system. The other two groups that we included were preschool for private school scholarships. These would be children that come from free and reduced lunch families. It's charter school, pre-K, public school, and non-public school pre-K. And then for charter schools, it's basically school improvement money, and I'm assuming this amendment would be for school improvement money. The fiscal note, that the savings, of course, is based on the non-public part of that, and that's the way the Florida laws are and the other laws. I would just say that I'll take any questions that people might have. We've the Minnesota Independent School Forum has been working on this, and also in combination with the Minnesota Council for American Private Education. We've been working on it for about 4 or 5 years. We wanted to bring it to the state. It'll make a big difference to the gap that we suffer from, our state suffers from. It will increase graduation rates, and basically it helps our poor families in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Fields. And I've learned since I last spoke that you are Mr. Cummings from the Department of Revenue. I apologize for not having remembered your name, sir. There's also a preliminary revenue estimate that talks about the costs for the administration of the program, Senator Sundrum, and that adds about $200,000 for the administration. I don't think that it fully assesses all the changes with your amendment, but it does add those costs as well. Mr. Cummings, comments about the estimates and what this amendment might do to the estimates?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Sundrum, just wanted to give some brief testimony about the bill. As noted in the fiscal note, there are some administrative concerns. There are new dimensions that this adds to the normal way in which we process these type of tax credits. In addition, there might be new responsibilities for the Commissioner of Revenue, new areas in which we haven't done. I know it talks about some auditing of various facilities or programs, and typically we don't normally do a programmatic audit, and so we just have, as this bill moves forward, we look forward to working with the chair and Senator Sundrum on trying to maybe clarify some points in the bill in order to kind of address some of the administrative concerns. I'm here speaking on behalf of the Department of Revenue and not any other person in the administration.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Senator Michelle.
And, Madam Chair, thanks. This is probably for Mr. Fields, who I know has been at this for years. Good work, Mr. Fields. My memory is that the state of Pennsylvania has a similar program to this. You referenced Florida earlier, but Pennsylvania has been doing this for
10 years.
4 or 5 years?
10 years.
I don't know if you can give us another minute on Pennsylvania.
Sure.
And how the success
in Pennsylvania.
Mr. Fields.
They have I don't want to get into too much detail, but they have a school improvement organization, so some of the money is used for school improvement, like we are talking about here, and also for scholarships for non-public schools. They started with $10 million. They're up to $75 million, I think, now, and basically the taxpayers liked it. They had to register to do it. And the line in front of the Department of Revenue, I understand, Pennsylvania is only a corporate tax credit, got so big on July 1st each year that the corporations just demanded that the cap be lifted.
Mr. Fields. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, not a question for whether Mr. Fields or Mr. Cummings or whoever. The cap in the bill, because we now have one without a cap, the cap that was projected in here, was there a cap? Was the cap in the original bill based on how much was individual versus how much was corporate? And if the cap is removed, been just trying to catch up on this a little bit, the corporations are not giving necessarily to a specific student, they're giving to a specific school. Is that correct? And if so, do we have any clue what kind of since I don't know what the caps were in here, other than I presume they're capped by the fiscal note here, I don't know if that's how many people it was or how we capped it. But I guess I'm trying to get a sense of what's the scope of this. When you say Pennsylvania, they removed the cap on number of amount of corporate money they'd give the credit to. What are we talking about in ballpark? I'm just curious about that.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I can tell you that the first year Arizona had this, they raised $98 million. 43 of that was for public schools, 54 was for private school scholarships. If it's a scholarship for a child going to a private school, it has to go through a foundation that represents at least two private schools. That keeps it within constitutional law. If it's a school improvement organization, it also a school improvement foundation, it also has to represent more than two schools, and that goes for improving the school. So it's used for things like the senator said, a child needs a quick tutor. And there's plenty of poverty kids in public schools that are embarrassed because they can't afford the uniform. They don't get to go on the field trip or whatever. It's used for that. I know one of our suburban schools have what they call an angel fund, and they said if they ever use this, that's what they would use it for. I can tell you as the person that's been working on this all these years, I never received a lot of enthusiasm from public school superintendents, but I did have two say that they would use this for their preschool because they are not fully funded for preschool. They have to charge something, and as soon as they do, that's when they lose that lower economic child, and that's the child they really want in the preschool. So that's why we put that part in the original bill.
Thank you. Senator Sundrum, I just want to say I appreciate the amendment that you're going to add the potential for these grants in the public schools. I think about my own son who's a junior, and we pay football fees and jazz band fees and pep band fees and robotics fees, and I don't know how some families can possibly afford that, and you'd hate to tell them that they couldn't have their children participating when their children wanted to. That's one of the opportunities we like to give them, and so I think you're trying to find a way to get to some real need, and I appreciate your work on this very much.
Madam Chair, that was some of the discussion in the Education Committee that led to the amendment.
Thank you. Other questions or comments from members? Without further objection, the Chair would like to lay over Senate File 641 for possible inclusion.
Madam Chair, may I just say, this is big. This is pretty bold. This is expensive. But the more I've looked at it, the more I do feel there's some downstream returns here that are good, both for the kids and, frankly, financially for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Senator Sundrum. We are going to take up Senator Chamberlain's bill. In the meantime, I'd like to clarify that the tobacco bill presented by Senator Rosen, I would like to move to lay that over for possible inclusion, Senate File 493. I misspoke, and I sent Senate File 450 twice. So I'd like to act on Senate File 493 without objection. Senate File 493 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Senator Chamberlain and the folks from Lionel Lakes, thank you for your patience with us this morning, and welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and the remaining members. Best for last, I must say. TIF talk. We have a bill here, 653. It is Lionel Lakes has approached us. They're looking for a little bit of legislative flexibility. For the record, Lionel Lakes is a city that's very successful. They don't take LGA. They don't charge local option sales tax. They're well managed, and they work hard up there. But in a nutshell, and I'll let them explain it, got a couple of TIFs up there. One got stuck in the with the recession, so they ran into a little trouble with that. The other TIF is doing very well, so they're looking for a little legislative relief and flexibility so they could use some funds from the successful TIF and apply it to the other TIF district. With that, I'll let them explain it as briefly as possible.
Thank you very much. We have are you Mayor Reinert?
Oh, Madam Chair, my name is Mike Groschella. I'm the Community Development Director for the City of Lionel Lakes. With me today is Mary Alice Devine, our Economic Development Coordinator. Thank you for the time, and I will shoot for that cup of coffee.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Groschella.
In 2004, the city embarked on a 40-acre redevelopment project adjacent to County State Aid Highway 23 and Interstate 35W with support from Anoka County and the Metropolitan Council. To make that redevelopment possible, the city provided financing both for the reconstruction of that interchange at about $10.6 million and the streets and utilities for the legacy development itself. Impact of the recession, we did complete the development infrastructure and the interchange improvements. A portion of the site developed, including a hotel, YMCA, as well as a mixed-use building. However, the development stalled with that recession. The unprecedented economic circumstances led to the remaining 22 acres of that site being foreclosed on by the lender. The lead lender bank failed. The participating lenders abandoned the foreclosed properties, and as we sit now, 22 acres of property has gone tax forfeit in 2010. What that means to the city, or the result, is the city has outstanding general obligation bonds secured by special assessments, which are not being paid any longer, as well as underperforming tax increments on the tax increment district that is not generating any revenues. Those required debt obligations have a potential for a large property tax impact for the city. Our proposal is to extend the duration of an existing economic development district located along County State Aid Highway 23 to in part cover the debt service requirements for the legacy improvement bonds as well as the interchange bonds. The total debt service on the legacy bonds themselves is about $530,000 a year. The interchange bonds are $385,000 a year. The proposed estimated increment that would be generated by extending the district is about $170,000. So the city will still be carrying a significant burden on these projects. However, this amount would certainly help in our flexibility in, one, trying to reduce the impact on the local property taxpayers, as well as assist, more importantly, getting the property back on the tax rolls, which is a benefit not only to the city, but to the state, the county, and the school district.
Extending the duration of that district so I can keep funding the limit.
Okay, so technically you are combining the two TIF districts so that you can use the revenues from one towards the expenses of the other?
Madam Chair, indirectly, we would be extending the district, actually allowing us to pull the duration of the economic development district for 10 years, and then allowing the pooling of that dollars to be used for costs associated with the first district. So it wouldn't necessarily be combining them directly, but be using them for the same purposes.
Do you know, sir, what the taxable value is for the two TIF districts if they were on the property tax rolls?
Mary Ellis.
Madam Chair, the first TIF district
Excuse
is
me, could you state your name for the record?
It's Mary Devine, Economic Development Coordinator for the City of Lionel Lakes.
Thank you, Ms. Devine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first tax increment district, 1-10, is a 10-year economic development district. It has two industrial properties that have been built in there with a combined value, and I don't have those exact numbers, but I would say in the area of about $17 million.
Thank you. Senator Chamberlain, were you here when we took up Senator Senjum's bill that would extend deadlines for TIF districts that were already in operation? Would your proposal for Lionel Lakes fit into his bill? If we acted on his bill, would that solve or fulfill the request you've made here, or do you need something different than that?
Madam Chair, we need something different. I had another bill along the same day extending for 2 years the window to start construction. So this is a different, that bill and the bill I previously presented for TIF are different than this. They need an extension of that, of this, so they can cover the bond payments of the troubled TIF district. So the current, the district where they want to use the money, they want to extend that to match the bond payoff for the troubled district. So it's a bit different, yes.
All right. And Senator Chamberlain and Mr. Groschella, did I say that right? Have you had public hearings and taken public testimony on the proposal to do this in your community?
We have had discussion with the city council. The city council is very supportive of this. We have recently just met with the Anoka County Intergovernmental Committee also. We are anticipating that the county board will take action this week, or actually next Tuesday, in support of this project.
But to date, no official action from the city to request or support this?
Correct.
Right. Will you keep us updated on that?
Will do.
I appreciate that. Other questions or comments from members? Senator Howell.
One question, Madam Chair. Have you expired any TIF districts in the city of Lionel Lakes?
That's
Madam Chair.
Ms. Devine.
And committee members, yes, we have expired numerous TIF districts. I would say within recent years, at least three economic development districts have been decertified.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hall. Other questions or comments for Senator Chamberlain? Is there anyone here to speak either in for or against this proposal? If not, then the chair would, without objection, lay over Senate File 653 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, folks, for being
thank
here.
You, thank you.
Without further business before the committee, we are adjourned. Thank you.